The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We were speaking earlier on to Jack Horgan-Jones from the Irish Times, who walked us through an awful lot of the coverage, or rather I should say walked us through the coverage, of which there is an awful lot, of Nikita Hann's successful action against Conor McGregor, wherein she asserted that she had been raped by the MMA star in a Dublin hotel and sued him civilly for assault, and a jury found in her favour and has awarded her €248,603 in damages. The Irish Times, leading with a jury in civil case, finds McGregor raped woman in Dublin hotel. The Irish Examiner, keep on fighting for justice. The Irish Independent, speak up and keep fighting, says survivor of McGregor attack. And the Irish Daily Mail, defeated. And there is a picture of Conor McGregor with his eyes closed in the back of his car, and a picture of Nikita Hann on the front page. And it says, McGregor did assault woman in hotel, jury finds. One person who was covering the entire trial all of the way through and heard all of the evidence and legal argument is our own Frank Graney. And Frank, there are a number of legal niceties or legal peculiarities about this that I want to ask you about in relation to burden of proof and all that. But before that, you sat through all of this. Can you give us a sense of how the trial unfolded and the way the evidence was laid out and what was most impactful on either side?
Oh, it's a very good question. Clearly, over the course of 2 weeks, I mean, I have a note of 50,000 odd words taken. There was an awful lot of evidence. And in a case, as was the case here, where it is a he said, she said situation, I think you have to give an awful lot of stock to what the parties are saying in their direct evidence and under cross-examination. And that's why it's so important, I think, to have witnesses giving evidence in person. It's a very important part of the legal system, any legal system, that a juror can look into the whites of a person's eyes to see how they're behaving in the witness box, to see how they're delivering their answers. That's something that may have been lost in reportage, you know, reading articles. And there were an awful lot of articles written over the past few weeks. And in my coverage too, you have to be very careful not to inject that kind of colour into your reportage. But certainly I think their testimony, Nikita Hann, firstly, I mean, I was looking at her before she took the stand, and I wondered if she was going to physically be able to get into the witness box, because she was so distressed before she was called. She clearly knew it was coming. She was hyperventilating. She struggled to find her breath as she made the short walk past Conor McGregor and into the witness box. And she was there for 3 or 4 days. She was an incredible witness, in my opinion. Yes, there were lies told, and she accepted that there were lies told, not to the jury, but to her boyfriend during the course of all this, about her whereabouts on the night, about where she was. Look, that didn't look good for her, and an awful lot was made of that. But at the end of the day, it's not a crime to lie. People tell lies for lots of reasons. She said that she didn't want to worry her boyfriend. She didn't want to tell him who she was with for that reason. And then you contrast that, I suppose, with the evidence of Conor McGregor, who flatly denied all of the allegations, claiming what happened in the hotel that day was fully consensual. And you know, some of the terminology that he used struck me, and certainly from my observation sitting directly across from the jurors, struck many of the jurors too. You know, particularly I'm reminded of his account of meeting the second named defendant, his friend James Lawrence, who the jury didn't find against yesterday, I should say. And he described how they pulled up the two girls, Nikita Hann and her friend Danielle Keeley, were in the back of the car, and he goes into the car and he's telling the jury, he said to James, look, I have these beautiful girls, they're outside, they're ready to party. And, you know, James Lawrence went out and joined them, and they went to the Beacon Hotel, and we now know what unfolded after all of that. So I think the jurors would have been, and they were a very diligent jury, and I think they were, you know, taking a lot of notes during the testimony. But in terms of the evidence around all of that, one thing that and clearly we don't know, such as the sanctity of the jury room, but one thing I think that would have been front and centre of their deliberations were the photographs of the injuries that she suffered.
Now, just let me give a warning before we get into this, because obviously this gets us into an area of medical evidence and of trauma. So if it is something that you would find disturbing, now may be a good time to switch off. Sorry. So go on.
Yeah.
This evidence, this linked to the paramedic in question saying there was some of the worst bruising that they had seen.
Yeah. And then the photographs were shown to the jurors, and I saw a handful of them myself, and it's fair to say that Nikita Hand was black and blue from head to toe. She said it herself that she was battered and raped, and the photos certainly supported her claim. She had a nasty injury on her breast that she claimed happened when Conor McGregor was pressing down on top of her in the bedroom of the penthouse suite, and she scratched herself with her watch, a pretty nasty gash. And also, Nikita Hand gave evidence of being on her period. And she said that she wouldn't have had sex that night regardless, but she certainly wouldn't have had sex while she was on her period. She had a tampon in. She went to the sexual assault treatment unit at the Rotunda Hospital. She was very concerned about that tampon because it was still in afterwards. And without going into too much detail, I do appreciate it's, you know, very early in the morning for this kind of content, but... You know, a doctor gave evidence of having to remove that.
Did you have a sense then, as you're watching the jury as this is going in, what sort of reactions were you seeing? Because one of the things in, I think the Irish Independent is talking about it today, they said that you could see ripples of reaction to the from the jury during McGregor's testimony when he became enraged.
Yeah, there was an outburst at one point, and that was under cross-examination. Nikita Hand's barrister was cross-examining her, and he directed a level of vitriol towards her in the public gallery. And up until that point, I must say he was calm and collected throughout. He was giving his evidence. Obviously, you know, giving your direct evidence is a lot less pressure than when you're being cross-examined by a barrister for the other side. And he certainly, as John Gordon said on behalf of Nikita Hand in his closing address, he said that Conor McGregor let his mask slip in that moment, and certainly taking note of some of the reactions of the jurors. They were quite taken aback, I think is the best way to put it, by that outburst, which was very brief. In terms of the evidence then that the defence relied on, the CCTV footage would have featured heavily. This was CCTV footage taken from the lift that brought them to and from the penthouse suite in the Beacon Hotel, the underground car park where the entourage two vehicles would have come in and taken the parties away later.
And was that shown in open court?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
How clear was it? Because we heard subsequently that they sought a larger monitor and a HDMI cable, one assumes, so that they could see it better. Is this small, grainy and in the distance, or is it visible?
No, I mean the quality was quite good. You know, as far as CCTV goes, you could clearly make out everybody. And now, when Nikita Hand was being cross-examined about certain elements of it, you know, giving Conor McGregor a hug as he was leaving, and this would have been after he attacked her in the penthouse suite, and giving him a little peck on the back of the arm, she said that it wasn't clear from the footage, from her viewing of it, that she had done all of that. But certainly after Conor McGregor left, she could be seen going up and down to the penthouse suite in the lift. No cameras in the corridors, no cameras in the penthouse suite, but she was in the company of James Lawrence, and was described as lovey-dovey, very affectionate towards him, and she had her arm around him, she was kissing him and whatnot, and for all intents and purposes they looked like a couple, you know, having a hotel break. But I think, like, and a lot was made of that in terms of, like, how could she be behaving like this, having just been viciously assaulted and raped by an MMA fighter? And I suppose the argument that was being put forward by her was, I don't remember any of that. Her case was that there was delayed shock, and I believe her. I mean, I think, like, you know, what a lot of people don't realise is that, and I've covered, sadly, cases involving sexual violence quite regularly over the last decade or so. And, you know, when somebody is attacked in such a way, they rarely run down the street, you know, in various degrees of undress, flailing arms, crying for help. That's for the movies. That's Hollywood. People behave in very different ways and often bizarre ways. And you know, I think you can describe her behaviour afterwards as odd and bizarre, and she would have accepted that herself. But things did start slowly coming back to her as the evening wore on. She has since been diagnosed with severe PTSD. What happened to her in that room has had a huge effect on her physically and mentally, and there are side effects that she is still struggling with to this day.
I mentioned earlier on that there are some interesting legal issues relating to this. The first and most significant is the burden of proof, because there is a lower bar for the proof required in a civil action like this rather than in a criminal action. Briefly, difference between balance of probability and reasonable doubt.
Well, the balance of probabilities is essentially when you have two versions of events, which clearly was the case here. He said, she said, the jury would be expected to consider all of the evidence, to consider the testimony, the exhibits, the CCTV and whatnot, and to decide which version of events was more likely or more probable to be the case than the other. And clearly, and certainly in relation to the case being made against Conor McGregor, they felt her version of events was more probable. Now, if that case had found itself being dealt with up the quays in the Criminal Courts of Justice before a jury at the Central Criminal Court, the standard of proof that the DPP would have had to prove on behalf of the people of Ireland would have been beyond a reasonable doubt. So there is...
Which means, in essence, a jury can say, we really think this happened, but we can't 100% swear to it, therefore we can't give the verdict.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So... I mean,
it's a very high bar.
Yeah, in general terms, like a good defence barrister in a criminal trial, whatever that criminal offence may be, all they really need to do is raise seeds of doubt and give those seeds of doubt to the jury in evidence when they retire to deliberate. And clearly where the seeds of doubt outweigh the evidence suggesting guilt, they have to give an accused person the benefit of the doubt.
Well, that answers a question that is coming in repeatedly. Anton, why didn't the DPP take this case? It sounds like there was evidence. I think undoubtedly there was prima facie evidence, but what the DPP thought and subsequently reviewed was that the likelihood of being able to prove it to that reasonable doubt bar was a significant challenge. Although there's interesting analysis in the papers on by criminal barristers on both sides, suggesting that it could have been argued or not. Now, as to that, the damages and the nature of the damages, the €248,000 will be paid by Conor McGregor to Nikita Hand, but there was scope for other damages which weren't awarded. Why?
Yeah, well... As to why, I mean, we don't know. The eight women and the four men of the jury that assessed damages are the only ones that can answer that question. There are four categories of damages that they had to consider when they found against Conor McGregor, and they were general, special, aggravated and punitive. They found or they assessed and award damages in relation to the first two of those, general and special. So that's things like medical expenses. You know, we've heard that she has been counselling quite regularly since, you know, hospital bills, GP bills, medication, things like that. And also loss of earnings. She hasn't been able to return to her career. She made a couple of attempts, albeit unsuccessfully, to return to the workplace, and she has struggled to do so since. So they would have calculated her loss of earnings to date and also future loss of earnings arising out of what happened in the Beacon Hotel. I think the breakdown was 60 grand general, and then the rest was special damages. So that's mostly loss of earnings. Now, she was looking for, at the outset of the trial, the jury was told that in the pleading, she was suing him for 750 grand for rehousing, which was described as a novel application by the barrister representing Conor McGregor.
Because she says she's had to leave her home.
She's had to leave her home, yes. The jury heard about, the jury didn't actually hear about this. I'm sure they've read about it and heard about it since. In the absence of the jury, there was an application to introduce evidence that there was a break-in at Nikita Hand's home over the summer. A number of masked men broke in through a front window. She was in bed with her boyfriend at the time. This is a terrifying experience that was outlined to the court. Her boyfriend was stabbed. Her daughter, her young daughter, was asleep in an adjoining room. Now, and it is very important to point out that the blame for that was not laid at the door of Conor McGregor, but those responsible were described as supporters of Conor McGregor. So she had to leave her home, had to leave her hometown, and that's why she was looking for 750 grand for rehousing.
But it is worth saying the judge decided that that was not something that the jury should be made privy to, and that it wasn't relevant.
Absolutely decided that it wasn't relevant. And she was also looking for 1 million in loss of earnings. So, you know, that's 1,750,000 that she was looking for. She got a little under a quarter of a million yesterday, which is still a hell of a lot of money, but it's streets away from, I suppose, you know, what she was suing him for.
And on those four categories that you outlined, the latter two, aggressive and punitive, or aggravated and punitive, as I understand it, what they are is a jury has the capacity effectively to say that the behaviour of the person against whom they are finding has been so egregious subsequent and in the running of the court that they will award damages against it. That was what they didn't award, isn't that right?
Yeah, to put it in very simple terms, and the judge would have gone into a lot more detail in relation to them before they began their deliberations, but there are damages that are awarded, additional damages awarded in cases like this where there is an added shock to the plaintiff. So take, for example, if her character has been called into question, if lies have been told, if there has been an element of collusion, which was an allegation being made by her side against Mr. McGregor and James Lawrence, that they had concocted a story to get away with all of this. And also punitive damages then are damages that shock the jury, where they feel that the wrongdoing is worthy of that additional punishment and to act as a deterrent to influence maybe future conduct and to, you know, send out a message that this type of behaviour and this type of wrongdoing is not acceptable in society as a whole.
Can I ask you a little bit about Nikita Hand and what this action shows about her character? Because I would have thought if you look at the most challenging actions it is possible to take, one of them is sexual assault claims, because they are a very difficult thing to go through if you have to give testimony about it. The other is a civil action when the DPP has decided they're not going to prosecute, which increases the pressure. Another would be taking on somebody who you know has deep pockets, because that can be hugely challenging given the court costs. And the other is taking on somebody who is a significant celebrity in your local community. She faced all four of those and went nonetheless. It goes to her courage, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm really glad that you've asked that question. She is a remarkable woman because... And it's really important to point out, like, their side were trying to portray her as a gold digger. It was described, her claim was described as an attempt at extortion, that she was just in it for the money. And, I mean, that wasn't the case. Like, look, she was compensated to the tune of just under $250,000 yesterday. But that's not what this is about. It wasn't about money. It was about vindication. Because her first port of call was to state authorities. She, you know, made a formal complaint of rape against, an allegation of rape against Conor McGregor that was investigated in the DPP. Decided there was insufficient evidence and not a reasonable prospect of a conviction. So they decided not to bring a prosecution, okay? And what she did next then to seek out that vindication was she went down this civil route, knowing and being fully live to the fact that by doing so, she wouldn't have the same protections that she would have had if these were criminal proceedings, in that her identity would not have been protected. We knew her name from day one. We have seen her picture splashed across the papers every day since this trial began. She knew she was opening herself up to that kind of exposure. And she also, sexual complaints are very, very difficult cases to run and very, very difficult cases to prove when it is a case of one person's word against another and it goes down to a jury of your peers. That is a very difficult situation to be in. And let's also not forget something that will be dealt with by the courts later in the week, the legal bill at the end of this. She would have been fully aware that if she lost this case, she was facing a whopping legal bill. There were more lawyers than journalists in court every day, and there were a hell of a lot of journalists in there too. You know, we're looking at about $1.5 million, a fairly reliable source told me, that could be the potential legal bill at the end of this. So she would have been on the foot for that if she had lost. So I think that speaks volumes of the courage and the bravery it took this woman to bring the allegation all the way.
Two final things. What next? One you have outlined, which is the decisions around costs, which we will await during the coming week. The other, the decisions around appeal. Conor McGregor said immediately after the action that it was his intent that he would appeal.
Yeah, in contrast to Nikita Hand, after that verdict was delivered yesterday, and I must say, Conor McGregor, for the first time I have ever seen the man looking very upset. He was a very, very nervous man before that verdict came in, understandably given, I suppose, what was at stake. But he was, you know, such a contrast to the cool, calm, cocky, confident, some might say arrogant character that we've known through his fighting over the years. He took two very deep breaths before the jury came back. He was a nervous man and he was clearly upset when the verdict went against him. He left very soon afterwards, jumped into the back of a Bentley with his fiancée, Dee Devlin, who was in court with him for the first time yesterday. Nikita Hand stuck around and she made a very powerful statement outside court afterwards. Conor McGregor then went online later in the evening to indicate his intention to appeal. He said that he had already instructed his lawyers to do so. So, I mean, the next port of call will be next Thursday. The court is going to sit and they're going to assess and adjudicate on that legal bill, which is the case with all civil cases. The loser pays the bill. So the loser in this case is Conor McGregor. He won't like being described as such. In fact, he was asked about a fight that he lost in the octagon. He got quite uncomfortable in the witness box when he was asked about that under cross-examination. And he said, you know, like in any fight, you win some, you lose some. But he has lost this and he will be on the hook for not only her compensation, but also the legal bill. So he has indicated his intention to appeal. Those papers, as far as I know, haven't been lodged yet. He will be given a certain amount of time to do that. So time will tell if he does challenge the decision of the jury yesterday. But I think Nikita Hand, I think it's really important that she's front and centre of this story, that she gets her moment, because this has been a really difficult 2 weeks for her, but it's been a really nightmarish 6 years for her as well. So, you know, it's great that she finally felt that she got her justice yesterday.
Frank Graney, thank you very much for that analysis. That is Frank Graney, our courts correspondent. Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, by the way, has a national 24-hour helpline. If any of the issues we have been discussing affect you, you can contact the free phone 24-hour national helpline on 1-800-77-8888 at any time of day or night. And they offer a free and confidential listening and support service for anyone who has been raped, sexually assaulted, sexually harassed or sexually abused at any time in their lives.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.